Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And as we kind of keep you attuned to the, you know, the evolution of our government, we're in the throes right now of going through the ratification debates, and we're going to jump into the New York ratification debates. And what we're going to do is we're going to prove to you how, you know, very assertive Hamilton is in the Federalist Papers versus his assertions. And we're only focused on the last eight Federalist Papers, technically the last seven, because the last eight, the eighth one is more of a conclusion, not necessarily focused on the judiciary. So my point being is that what Hamilton did in the Federalist Papers was literally provide verbal justification for the court to assume powers that were not granted. But before we get into that, I want to just make sure I remind you that there's a constitutional champion running for state auditor in Missouri, Gerald Wistrand, and please go get to his page, send him money. He is in need of money. As our only endorsed candidate, folks, there's people that just hand away their endorsements. You know, Trump, I like this guy, I like this guy. What, regardless of the outcome and their positions, as long as they have money or whatever the criteria is, it is a low bar. I will not endorse anybody unless they have signed the pledge. I ask every candidate out there, and at this point in time, no candidate is willing to risk their election and, you know, basically, you know, come out and admit that they're, because they, if they feel like they have the best shot at making it, they're not going to, you know, risk their career, I should say, on signing a commitment to stepping down out of office if they violate their oath of office. And so they don't want you to know that. They don't care about having this until you start demanding that they will and immediately step down out of office if they have a First Amendment petition proving that they violated the Constitution, that it would require going to a common law court to refute. I mean, something that he just can't say, oh, I didn't do that, you know, because that's what they'll do. Anybody that is a two-faced or a four-tongued liar will try to do anything. But when you give them a good, substantial, you voted for this, this is clearly unconstitutional, and if they make these pleas, oh, well, I had no choice, any crap like that to try to stay in office, they will do it if they think they can get away with it. And so that's why they stay away from this pledge, because they know, as more you know about it, there's a good likelihood they'll never get reelected if they get caught. And if we have our way and you actually start doing your job and you start holding them accountable, that means that they're getting caught. I hope you understand all this. I hope you understand this. This is why having Gerald in leading the front of the line, signing this pledge and being, you know, the only one currently for 2026. And that's okay, because, folks, I don't have time to go and chase people. You may want to start demanding that your candidate for commissioner, your candidate for state legislature, your candidate for Congress, hey, if you don't sign G.R. Mobley's or the Reclaiming the Republic's pledge on supporting the Constitution, supporting your oath of office, then I'm not going to vote for you. And just when people hear that, then all of a sudden they kind of, well, they get into the defensive. Well, what is this pledge? So, folks, until you start demanding it, then it really means nothing. But we have to start demanding that they actually fulfill their oath of office, that they do step down in accordance with Section 3. So welcome back, Sean. And, you know, we got you back. I don't know if you have any go-backs, but I have a go-back. You got a go-back?
No, sir. You go ahead back.
Okay, I'm heading back. And what that means, folks, is when we were covering the articles of the Federalist Papers, in the last article, there was kind of this layout of, you know, how, and I made this comment regarding implied powers, how Hamilton started injecting implied powers. And implied powers, the leverage or the portal. As a matter of fact, Madison addressed these portals in the bonus bill. What are these portals? These are clauses within the Constitution that the illiterate, if you do not understand the Constitution and they tell you the General Defense and Welfare Clause, then, oh, well, they, you know, they have these powers due to the General Defense and Welfare Clause that they can do anything, right? Well, no. No, the General Defense and Welfare Clause isn't actually a clause declaring power. We've covered this before, but it is the preamble to the following powers. That's why there is actually an enumeration or a listing of powers that are being granted to the federal government, specifically Congress. So when we look at the bottom of the powers in the very final part of Article 1, Section 8 is the Necessary and Proper Clause, which basically states that Congress, let me see here. Let me actually just pull it up so I can read it for you. And so the Article 1, Section 8 says this, that Congress shall have the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in the department or officer thereof. So in other words, those powers that are absolutely listed in Article 1, Section 8, or in an amendment of the Constitution. Because in the original draft of the Constitution, the powers were all listed in Article 1, Section 8. If it's listed in an amendment, you won't find it in Article 1, Section 8. You'll find it in maybe the 19th Amendment, or I think it's the 19th Amendment, which was the Prohibition Amendment, which gave them the power to regulate distilled liquor, or basically making distilled liquor illegal and to control and regulate, you know, the flowing of alcohol to America. So just so you understand, that's why that clause of the Necessary and Proper Clause clearly states for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. These are what we have, and all other powers vested in this Constitution for further amendments and those types of things. So anyway, the point is that the General Defense and Welfare Clause that's at the very top of Article 1, Section 8 is, to be clear, that's a preamble, and at the very end, it's kind of like a summation or what have you. In the ratification debates, they clearly delineated that those were not implied powers. They were not granting any additional powers. As a matter of fact, I think a few times in the different ratification debates, it was mentioned that they could have said on the end of each line, such as to borrow money on the credit of the United States and to make all laws necessary for carrying into execution this power. And then at the next line, you know, and then basically being redundant at the end of the powers, making sure that they could make the necessary laws to carry into execution this power. That's how they described it, to say it's not granting any power, it's only granting the powers for carrying into execution the foregoing, again, the foregoing powers. I feel like I'm being redundant on this, but there are people, duplicit people, that literally try to take advantage of getting you to read the Necessary and Proper. Oh, well, they can, you know, make all laws necessary and proper and not read the final part. Not read that last part to say for the foregoing powers. And this is kind of like those people that want to mislead you on the scriptures. They'll only read you a little context of the scripture, not the whole scripture. or the, you know, citations in academic writings that they want. They've got an agenda. They found some words that meet their agenda of what they're trying to do, but the full context doesn't. That's why they basically parse it to only give you what they want you to see. Now, like I said, Madison put this and shot this down in 1816 in his veto statement against the bonus bill. But in the ratification base, they were clear that there was these portals. Another portal is the supremacy clause. Another portal is, let me see, there's the supremacy, oh, the commerce clause. The commerce clause is a quasi-portal because it's not a broad in every aspect of granting powers like the supremacy clause, necessary and proper clause, or the general defense. Those are very ambiguous. The commerce clause basically opens up the portal when it comes to regulating commerce. Boy, they can just regulate all commerce. But to be clear, the commerce clause is stipulated to regulating commerce among the states, not within the states. But this is how they started going down this path of using the Commerce Clause to come in and say, we're going to regulate your wheat. We're going to start regulating. And in Wicker v. Filburn in 1943, when a farmer decided he didn't want to pay taxes on when he was buying his wheat to feed his cattle, he grew his own wheat to feed his cattle. And in so doing, the federal government goes, hey, there's this huge cattle farmer. And I think this, I forget what state it was in. But there's this cattle farmer that's growing, you know, he's got all this cattle that he's growing and was feeding, buying from the system, buying from the market this wheat to feed his cattle. And now he's growing his own. So we're not making money on this. Why did our revenue in the state go down? They went after this guy. They started charging him tax on what they could have actualized if that wheat was brought into the market, what he would have had to pay on the sales tax in purchasing this. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of taxing him on it. So, if you start digesting this, this is how the courts started actually becoming the primary bully out of the government. I mean, Congress would get aggressive, the tax agents would get aggressive, the bureaucracies get aggressive, and then next thing you know, the court's supporting it. Now, there has been a little ebb and flow, what most people, it's not all bad. You know, I'm just telling you, the devil will tell you 9 truths as long as you buy that one lie. And that's how I see it.
Did God truly say?
What's that?
Did God truly say? That's the original lie that all of the rest of this corruption is built on. Genesis 3.
There we go. So the point I'm trying to make here is that when we really look at this concept of implied powers, that implied powers were just these things that Hamilton was trying to use to basically help justify the federal government in assuming powers not granted, like creating a bank and so forth. So the point is that now when we went through paragraph 19, or in Article 81, Federalist Paper number 81, when we went through that, there was this talk about causes and ruling on law and fact. Well, Marshall was the first one that actually started babbling in his opinions that, like in Maryland v. McCullough, I think that was an 1817 or 1819 case, in Maryland v. McCullough, he basically said that the federal government used the supremacy clause in justifying that the federal government could do whatever it wanted to do and that the states couldn't challenge the federal government at all. And he also used the necessary and proper clause that whatever the federal government deemed or determined which was necessary and proper, they could do by applying that supremacy clause. So he started using these clauses in his opinions, out of context, to help drive opinions, or I should say rulings, down the road. This was done very, the sophistry of this was just amazing. Because how did these gentlemen know back in later on in the 1830s and later, when they started looking at Marshall's rulings, how did they know that those things were there unless Marshall knew what he was doing because he was using the Federalist Papers so that this concept of interpretation became, you know, embraced. And, oh, guess what? Marshall was the first interpreter, because it goes back that far. Nobody then started challenging that, hey, if Marshall was interpreting the law in his opinions, then that's as good as gold as far as we're concerned. And everybody bought it. And what scares me is there's so many people that look to the court as this gold standard. I mean, they are the essence of what is true, and they are not. As a matter of fact, I'm doing a presentation that, and I've created a presentation. I want to share this with other people. I created a presentation that literally lays out a Republican form of government. I place context to how the courts were never important in our design. Their function was important in providing justice between two parties of a controversy. They were not important in creating law. They were not important in interpreting law or anything like that. Their job was a tough job to deliver justice as they conformed to the justice systems of the states. They couldn't change the states. And yet they do and have and will and are. So anyway, we kind of rushed in the last show, and I wanted to get back into this because this is how they started using the Constitution with what I call these portals of assuming new powers. Madison was very attuned to this by 1816, which is why he called out all four of these portals. The Commerce Clause, the General Defense and Welfare Clause, Necessary and Proper Clause, and the Supremacy Clause. If you read his veto statement, basically it's a one-pager. If you read his veto statement, he literally mentions all four of those clauses. Anyway, okay, so now we can go ahead and move forward with the about 7 minutes we have left here. And let's go ahead and dive into the 20th paragraph of this article, or this Federalist paper.
This view of the matter, at any rate, puts it out of all doubt that the supposed abolition of the trial by jury by the operation of this provision is fallacious and untrue. The legislature of the United States would certainly have full power to provide that in appeals to the Supreme Court there should be no reexamination of facts where they had been tried in the original causes by juries. This would certainly be an authorized exception, but if, for the reason already intimated, it should be thought too extensive, it might be qualified with limitation to such causes only as are determinable at common law in that mode of trial.
Okay, so, and it's interestingly enough, he's pointing to the legislature of the United States is the one that actually makes the determination of whether, you know, something needs to be done with trial by jury or what have you, that not the Supreme Court making these decisions themselves. Now, when we look today, because the Supreme Court in the 1835, they issued their first rules and procedures written by their own hand. In other words, Congress stopped doing it. They said, you know what? We trust us. We'll trust you too. You know, who doesn't trust themselves? Since I trust myself, I'm going to allow you to trust yourself because we're simpatico. I mean, you know, we're both trying to break out of this paper bag. And if we break out together, if I can break out first, I'm bringing you with me. Madison kind of pointed this, you know, not this, this metaphor, but he pointed out the fact that when one of the three branches successfully breaks through the Constitution in violating it, it basically applies to the other branches that they can do the exact same thing. They can equally violate the Constitution in the same ways. Anywho, let's go ahead and do paragraph 21.
21. The amount of the observations hitherto made on the authority of the Judicial Department is this, that it has been carefully restricted to those causes which are manifestly proper for the cognizance of the national judicature, that in the partition of this authority, a very small portion of original jurisdiction has been preserved to the Supreme Court, and the rest consigned to the subordinate tribunals, that the Supreme Court will possess an appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact in all the cases referred to them, both subject to any exceptions and regulations which may be thought advisable, that this appellate jurisdiction does, in no case, abolish the trial by jury, and that an ordinary degree of prudence and integrity in the national councils will ensure us solid advantages from the establishment of the proposed judiciary without exposing us to any of the inconveniences which have been predicted from that source.
Okay. Right here in his summation to this article, he basically placed, well, in concluding, I clarified that the jurisdiction for the appeal process is based on law and fact. Actually, the jurisdiction for all things must be based on law and fact because there was no granting of interpretation. So in other words, if there's anything, you know, in the original jurisdiction of all things arising under this Constitution where two states may be parties of or a state may be a party of, where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, it still must be based on law and fact. There was no granting of where you can interpret the law if necessary. If you didn't know what we meant, go ahead and interpret it. So in other words, when you look in the previous portion of the article and the other articles, when they say, hey, you know, you're not laying it out, or actually you've laid it out that they can interpret, they can create law, these other things. Well, he's kind of getting that interpretation separated, because if you're into the sophistry of debate and argument, he can literally say, well, I concluded that article laying out that their jurisdiction, you know, in the appeal process was based on law and fact, because he's not mentioning interpretation here. But when they want to use it to highlight, you know, so the whole point is that if this was actually in a debate, where what Hamilton was talking about, if this was a regular Federalist paper that was going in and the Anti-Federalists were debating it, he could use this last one to say, well, I kind of clarified that. And that's just, you know, a bookend. That's all it is. I mean, how much content and how much, you know, substance is in a bookend? Not much at all. The substance is really in the diving in and the further examining in the meat of the article. That's where everybody's looking for what they really want. So when you see this, you'll find that, you know, when somebody's actually, you know, saying one thing, but at the very end they say something different. That right there is created as their, well, look, you know, as I concluded, I said this. And then everybody in that room knows, oh, okay, well, that's what he must have meant. But down the road, when he wants to take latitude, he doesn't even mention this. What he mentions is the details that he wants to use for implied powers. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And so when it came down to going into Congress, he didn't go into this. Just remember, I concluded this. What he was doing was he was actually pulling out those things that he wanted to exploit in the meat of the examination. So with that, I guess it's a good time to just jump into a break here. And then when we come back, because this concludes Federalist Paper number 81. So when we come back, we're going to dive into Federalist Paper number 82. This gives us three more Federalist Papers, because I think Federalist Paper number 85 is the concluding Federalist Paper, which is really not focused on the judiciary. Anyway, so we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and just dive into Federalist Paper number 82. And again, let me see here. This is going into the McLean's edition of New York, and I think all of these, for some reason, went into the McLean's edition and not into the other presses, supposedly. So I think he probably had a good friend in McLean, where he gave McLean these articles, and then McLean may have actually printed a portion of a page or on a particular page did a dual print, so he tucked it into one of the newspapers, never promulgated it, but maybe it became a part of the record. Whatever. But I'm telling you, folks, there's no way Hamilton wanted anybody to see what he was putting in these. These were really to be used later to subvert the truth and the reality of a very limited and constrained judiciary. Very limited and constrained. They didn't have these latitudes that they're dancing around and trampling on our Constitution with today. So let's go ahead and to the people of the state of New York. Boom.
Number two, the erection of a new government, whatever care or wisdom may distinguish the work, cannot fail to originate questions of intricacy and nicety. And these may, in a particular manner, be expected to flow from the establishment of a constitution founded upon the total or partial incorporation of a number of distinct sovereignties. It is time only that can mature and perfect so compound a system, can liquidate the meaning of all the parts, and can adjust them to each other in a harmonious and consistent whole.
Okay. So, again, just kind of ambiguity and starting off, kind of like the generalization of a summation. So, let's go ahead. Three.
Number three, such questions, accordingly, have arisen upon the plan proposed by the convention, particularly concerning the judiciary department. The principal of these respect the situation of the state courts in regard to those causes which are to be submitted to federal jurisdiction. Is this to be exclusive, or are those courts to possess a concurrent jurisdiction? If the latter, in what relation will they stand to the national tribunals? These are inquiries which we meet with in the mouths of men of sense, and which are certainly entitled to attention.
Okay, all right, so we're going to examine this jurisdiction regarding concurrent jurisdiction. Go ahead.
The principles established in a former paper teach us that the states will retain all pre-existing authorities which may not be exclusively delegated to the federal head, and that this exclusive delegation can only exist in one of three cases. Where an exclusive authority is, in express terms, granted to the Union, or where a particular authority is granted to the Union and the exercise of a like authority is prohibited to the states, or where an authority is granted to the Union with which a similar authority in the states would be utterly incompatible. Though these principles may not apply with the same force to the judiciary as to the legislative power, yet I am inclined to think that they are, in the main, just with respect to the former as well as the latter. And under this impression, I shall lay it down as a rule that the state courts will retain the jurisdiction they now have, unless it appears to be taken away in one of the enumerated modes.
Okay, so again, and do me a favor, because the links are still alive. You've got the Word document right in front of you. And so that little one footnote on the first line right there with paper, you see that little one? Okay, so if you read paragraph four, the principles established in a former paper, and then there's a footnote on paper. You see that? Sean, are you muted?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I see it.
Okay. So if you put your mouse on that, it tells you what former paper he's talking about. The principles established in a former paper. What paper is he referencing here? If you look at the notes here, it says Founding Fathers Info, Federalist Papers, Fed 82. In other words, he's citing this very particular Federalist paper. At least that's what it's pointing to. But if you go down to the bottom, because what I think here is that there's a misalignment, because this is technically, you know, when you do a paper, you know, the citations in the paper have 1, 2, 3, 4, right? And then the next paper will have 1, 2, 3, 4. But when you combine them all, they all of a sudden start shifting. Does that make sense? So when we look at what he's talking about, the Library of Congress documents in the federal in American history, if you look at the sub-reference at the bottom of the page, I think this is the actual reference or citation. I'm just pointing this out because people could get tripped up on what he's doing here. But either way, what he's doing is he's referencing these bogus papers, Federalist Papers number 1 through 85. And technically, the Federalist Papers on the judiciary started with paragraph, or I should say, Federalist Paper number 78. But this right here is laying out the text of 81 through 85. And so that first citation for this page or this article that you see, boom, there it is. Now, I don't see any other citations on this page with the numbers or what have you. So I don't know if the foot page, if that's actually pointing to 82 or if it's actually pointing to 81, 85. Regardless, both prove that it's like an author that, because I do this, I'll actually cite my own work. Because in a different work, I've expounded enough upon something that I could say, as you know, we described, or as I described in this article, you know, and I just summarize it real quick, boom, get past that. You know, you can do that. Most people get criticized when they do that. But what do you do when nobody has examined things with the same light you have? How do you cite somebody else? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So when you go to the original citation, you'll actually find sub-citations to, you know, primary source documents that help me create the argument for that, you know, that assertion or that summation I put in the following paper. That way, when you kind of look at it, you go, okay, you know, I may be citing myself, but I when it comes down to all my conclusions come from the citation of primary source documents. These aren't editorials of other people or other people's conclusions. These are literally using what the framers said, and me, you know, if you want to say paraphrasing or interpreting or distilling what they were saying. See, distilling is, you know, doing it without any filtering and bias. Does that make sense? Well, I mean, distilling, there is some filtering process, but you're just filtering out content or, you know, substance, not necessarily, not substance, just, you know, the impurities, those types of things, things that wouldn't be the final product. Anyway, it's more important that when I do my work, I want to make sure that I try not to invoke ideas that have no, it's like, you know, you're making, you know, what is it, Everclear? You know, and you talk about Everclear as, you know, this blue water when Everclear is literally that clear. It's a, it looks like water. And you don't want to just drink it like water either. Because that's the distilling process. I mean, other distilling processes still maintain, you know, some form of color because they try not to filter out all of those. I don't want to call them impurities because Everclear is the process of getting all the impurities out, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I mean, I, you know, and forgive me if it's, if I've, it seemed like because you're in Louisiana, I was just making the conclusion that in the South, everybody had distilleries. No, I figured you were just familiar with the process of distilling. Okay. I wasn't trying to generalize and, you know,
no. We drink wine. We make wine.
Okay. All right. All right. So anyway, all right. So let's dive further with four, with five. Go ahead.
The only thing in the proposed Constitution which wears the appearance of confining the causes of federal cognizance to the federal courts is contained in this passage. Quote: "The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress shall from time to time ordain and establish," end quote. This might either be construed to signify that the supreme and subordinate courts of the Union should alone have the power of deciding those causes to which their authority is to extend, or simply to denote that the organs of the national judiciary should be one Supreme Court and as many subordinate courts as Congress should think proper to appoint. Or in other words, that the United States should exercise the judicial power with which they are to be invested through one supreme tribunal and a certain number of inferior ones to be instituted by them. The first excludes, the last admits, the concurrent jurisdiction of the state tribunals, and as the first would amount to an alienation of state power by implication, the last appears to me the most natural and most defensible construction.
Okay, so this is interesting. If you read what you just read, folks, and I've highlighted this part in red, this might either be construed to signify that the Supreme and subordinate courts of the Union should alone have, when he says subordinate courts of the Union, he's talking about the federal district courts, not the state courts. See, in my paradigm, because we went through this before, the courts of the Union would be state courts, because when you look at laws, the federal government has the ability to create laws. There's two types of laws that they can create. One type of law is applicable to the federal government alone. The other type of law is applicable to the states, the Union. And so the differentiator to me is the Union refers to the states, not, you know, the federal government's apparatus in, you know, in executing its laws or executing its roles and responsibilities, such as the inferior. So to me, I would not have used the Union here. I would have referred to the federal district courts, the inferior courts, what have you, instead of the Union. Okay, so, but what he says of the courts of the Union should alone have the power of deciding those causes to which their authority is extended. And so he's not telling you what those authorities are. Is there anywhere here where he's talking, because he's basically laying it out here, that there's this implied, because at the very end, he basically says this, I think. The first excludes, the last admits, the concurrent jurisdiction of the state tribunals, as to the first would admit to an alienation of state power by implication, right there, In alienating, or basically the alienation of a state power by implication, the last appears to me the most natural and the most defensible construction. But he's talking about judicial power. And when you read Article 2, Section 1, that's what it basically says. The judicial power shall be vested in the Supreme, or in the federal court. Let's just stop right there and say that's what they're extending this power to. In this federal court, supreme and inferior, that is not listing their jurisdiction. But the way you read this, it's almost like their jurisdiction's wide open. Because it's not talking about what its jurisdiction is. You see anything there?
No, sir.
Right. So he's leaving it very ambiguous. Because the more jurisdiction the court has, or I should say, the more open its doors are to things it has no jurisdiction over, the more apt the court is in pulling these things under their control for the federal government. Because, folks, if you go into a court that has no jurisdiction over the matter you're taking into court, you are surrendering your sovereignty to a court with no jurisdiction. But the Constitution clarifies the jurisdiction in Article 3, Section 2, that the court shall have jurisdiction over all things in law and equity arising under this Constitution, and all laws made in pursuance to, and all treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, period, end of story. That's it. So that is what it is tied to. It's nowhere here where it's framing that tight, limited, or a limited and constrained jurisdiction. So he's created this, you know, by making this babbling argument, he's completely sidestepped away from what the jurisdiction is, and talking about their power is whatever their power wants to be over the things that they want it to be. Interesting. Okay, so let's go to paragraph 6, because he's using
this doctrine of concurrent jurisdiction.
Yeah,
is only clearly applicable to those descriptions of causes of which the state courts have previous cognizance. It is not equally evident in relation to cases which may grow out of and be peculiar to the Constitution to be established. For not to allow the state courts a right of jurisdiction in such cases can hardly be considered as the abridgment of a pre-existing authority. I mean not, therefore, to contend that the United States, in the course of legislation upon the objects entrusted to their direction, may not commit the decision of causes arising upon a particular regulation to the federal court solely, but if such a measure should be deemed expedient, but I hold that the state courts will be divested of no part of their primitive jurisdiction, further than may relate to an appeal. And I am even of opinion that in every case in which they were not expressly excluded by the future acts of the national legislature, they will, of course, take cognizance of the causes to which those acts may give birth. This I infer from the nature of judiciary power, and from the general genius of the system. The judiciary power of every government looks beyond its own local or municipal laws, and in civil cases lays hold of all subjects of litigation between parties within its jurisdiction, though the causes of dispute are relative to the laws of the most distant part of the globe. Those of Japan, not less than of New York, may furnish the objects of legal discussion to our courts. When in addition to this, we consider the state governments and the national governments, as they truly are, in the light of kindred systems and as parts of one whole, the inference seems to be conclusive that the state courts would have a concurrent jurisdiction in all cases arising under the laws of the Union where it was not expressly prohibited.
And, you know, he's not mentioning other states, and forgive me, You started reading, and I wanted to sneak in a little bit more about, see, he's clearly bringing up and using the word jurisdiction in the previous paragraph and in this one. So if you're not talking about what their jurisdiction is, but you're talking about general jurisdiction, then one would think that they have general jurisdiction. Or if you're generally talking about, you know, jurisdiction ambiguously, then it just, one would presume that they have, you know, a very wide open jurisdiction. Instead of, I would have thought, and I would have literally laid it out that the federal court, if, you know, and I would have created the cases of what that jurisdiction would be. That, you know, if somebody in the state was counterfeiting money, well, then they could be tried in a federal court because they have federal jurisdiction over that. Because it's clearly it arises under this Constitution. But if they're creating money that is a former state currency or a bill or what have you, then they would not be under the federal jurisdiction. And so I would compare, I'd create those types of comparison and contrast, or, you know, compare and contrast situations, so that people could literally see, the, you know, how little the federal court jurisdiction really is. But no, Hamilton wanted to literally just talk in general regarding their jurisdiction. Now, he also makes this little comment right in the middle of this. He says, I am even of the opinion that in every case in which they were not expressly excluded by the future acts of the national legislature, they will, of course, take cognizance of the cases to which those acts may give birth. So in other words, he's saying that when the federal government makes an assumption, just remember that the Constitution creates this very specific power of, like, to make a uniform rule of naturalization. So in that act of making a uniform rule of naturalization, because they can only constitutionally make acts that would be applicable as long as it is a derivative of that particular act. Actually, so I'm going to keep this in contrast to a topic. In other words, because I was going to use that along with money. But let's, because the money in banking. So let's, instead of using a uniform rule of naturalization, the coining of gold and silver. Clearly, only the federal government can coin gold and silver as tender for the legal payment of debt. So in other words, the only currency that the federal government would be concerned with would be the federal coins that they mint. Therefore, no state can mint any coin that is not theirs. Or I should say, they can't mint a coin of the state. The reason I was going down this path was in a state, they had bills. But the Constitution forbids them in Article 1, Section 10. From coining money or even further making bills. Bottom line, though, is if they were coining money, then that for the state, in other words, it wasn't U.S. Liberty dollars, they were coining money for the state, then that would be equally unconstitutional, but it would be left technically for the states to, you know, to arrest or what have you, because it's not counterfeiting. Right? They're not counterfeiting federal coins. They're just violating the restriction. So the state court would then need to basically say, hey, you know, you don't have the authority to do that. Technically, it would be pulled in because it does arise under this Constitution. But they have the authority because it is a part of the authority of coining money, as well as they can't coin money. But there's nowhere there that implies banking. So if the federal government tried to create a bank, which they did do, they actually assumed that authority. And when we look at this whole point of the future acts of the national legislature, If the legislature is passing an act that is a derivative of the power, a direct derivative, in other words, they're coining money, and they're going to create a mint to do that. They're going to create a repository of holding that, such as the United States Treasury Department. And these safes, national safes, or if you want to call them a holding center, you can even, if you want them, label it as a bank, just a storage of money, that's fine. But a bank creating bank products, such as selling bonds and those types of things, is not a direct derivative. And the reason I'm diving into this is because this is a perfect example of how down the road Hamilton used that very specific argument that, hey, it's implied. You know, we have the power to make these coins, so we have the power to create the bank. And if we can create the bank, then the next implication is we can create bank products. And if we can create the bank products, we can do this. And it's one implication after the next implication, if you understand what I'm saying. And the point is that he's laying it out there that if it was not expressly excluded in future acts. Well, hold on here. That means that down the road, if it's actually something that is open to the states, and the federal government does something, then they have to be expressly excluded? The states have to be expressly excluded? Or what? Does that make sense? Because the federal government and the states have different roles. Everything that is not delegated to the federal government is left to the states. If the federal government assumes something that they don't have the authority, does it need to be expressly excluded? No. Articles of Confederation literally said the powers not expressly granted are reserved to the states. And the use of expressly is one of those confusing words, because if it's not expressly excluded from, this is sophistry. In other words, if the federal government is not expressly excluded from something, then they can imply that they can do it. Does you see the turn there? And I think.
Oh, I see it.
Okay. All right, because this is all about, this very intricate web that he is planning on deploying and using and exploiting and corrupting people. Because bottom line, when he goes into this protected room of people that are far away from their states and are susceptible to the avarice of power, the avarice of money and intrigue and all of these things, Hamilton played them. Like I said, down the road, hopefully this year we can get to this, where if we don't get to it this year, then maybe we'll do this next year in expounding on things, because we're running out of time. Just because I'm taking and diving into these probably maybe way too far than I should, but I'm hoping this really helps, because I'm trying to show you. Another thing I haven't ever pointed out is when you look at the courts of the different states, New York was one of the very few states that had a judiciary that actually was independent, that was actually empowered with general powers, because their government had general powers just like Britain. In other words, they had unlimited powers. And so they were building upon this, and this paradigm was definitely within Hamilton, because he was a lawyer in New York and a resident and citizen. Folks, I'm Jerry Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.